Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is The Serial Finessist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom of the AndrewBlog.net to talk about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We talk about the value of diversity in superhero movies, the incredibly colorful animation, and how much of the movie was aimed at children. We are both are huge fans of Spider-Man in general and all of the different spider people, and it was a great time talking about it with Andrew. On to the discussion. Hello, everyone. I'm here once again with Andrew Bloom, the AndrewBlog.net. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing very well, but I have some bad news. I'm not actually Andrew Bloom. I am Robbie B. Dorman, a podcaster from another dimension.
Yeah. I get it. Dimensions. Do you know that there's parallel dimensions in comic books, Andrew?
Are there? Comic books are so staid and very down to earth. I don't know where that would fit in. Which number?
That's the question. We are discussing Into the Spider-Verse. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. The recent animated Spider-Man adjacent film.
I think it's not Spider-Man adjacent. It is, if anything, Spider-Man overflowing.
I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, it is not MCU Spider-Man. It is various other versions of Spider-Man all at the same time, all together, all being friends. Mostly Miles, though. Mostly Miles Morales with a older version of Peter Parker, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Ham, Spider-Man Noir. Not too strong on Spider-Man Noir myself. I'm
wait, you forgot Penny Parker and the Spider-Bot. Right.
Yeah, that one too. Which does make zero sense. Okay. There is Penny Parker. There's also there's the different Kingpin and the different Doc Ock and the different Norman Osborn. They're pulling in all these different permutations of Spider-Man using the various weird the multiverse of the Marvel Universe, which really doesn't see any play in the normal MCU. We don't get any of it, which is probably for the best, because there's enough characters already in... I mean, there's half of them than there used to be, but there's still a lot of characters in the normal MCU. So this is a way to kind of just disconnect from that, make a kind of a isolated story, disconnected from any kind of continuity in the normal MCU. And focus on Miles Morales from Ultimate Spider-Man, the comic book. I'm going to ask you a question, Andrew.
I'm going to give you an answer as best I can.
Okay. Is this movie great?
Yes, 100%. I'm probably softer on the one of the greatest comic book movies of all time front that I think a lot of people who I respect and like have put forward. But I think it is unquestionably great in my eyes for what it accomplishes, A, by introducing a new character to the audience, the movie-going audience, but B, just sort of how it melds the comic booky elements of its story with the sort of growth and emergence and origin story for Miles as Spider-Man at the same time. It balances the combination of here's people skipping through time and people skipping through different dimensions and alternate universes and all of that stuff on the one hand, but also has the young man trying to find himself material on the other hand, and somehow weaves it together in a really satisfying way. And I think that and the art style alone would put it in great territory for me. I take it you might disagree.
I'm going to preface. This is my preamble, my preface for everything I'm about to say in this entire podcast, because us just bouncing back and forth saying this is good and this is good and this is good and this is good doesn't necessarily always make for a great discussion. I think this movie is very good. I would recommend it to almost anyone. I don't think it's great. I think it's very good. And I don't, so any criticism I have of it, I will fall back on. I still think it's very good and does a lot of really good things, mostly in the writing, I would say, honestly. I mean, it's very beautiful. And I think that's, I don't think it's the greatest comic book. So many people are, it's the greatest comic book movie of all time. I disagree. I think it's very good, and I think it's fun. I don't think there's much depth to it, I think I understand why a lot of people say that, because this movie feels hip in the way that most of the MCU movies don't.
So can you unpack that a little bit for me in terms of what you mean about depth? Because I guess I from my perspective, I guess I think they do a lot for Miles' journey individually, but also there's complexity and depth to his relationship to his father, to his uncle, to Peter A. Parker, or just regular Peter Parker versus Peter B. Parker. There's a lot of connections in his life that forge who he becomes, and there's depth and complexity to not only his one-on-one interactions with each of them, but sort of how all of these ties that he has to people combine into one complete relationship and context that helps him become who he eventually becomes.
I don't know. I feel like it's one is wait, there's too many characters in this movie. I don't know why they picked Spider-Man Noir or Spider-Ham to put or Penny Parker for that. I liked everything with Miles and all the versions of Peter, the two versions. And Spider-Gwen's great. I love Spider-Gwen in the comic books. And I like the relationships with Miles a lot. I just wanted more of it. When they got to the fifth time they were doing like the comic book origin story thing, like, here's how this character became their Spider-Man. I got it, guys. I don't need Spider-Man Noir. In my dimension, it's the 30s. And I love Rubik's Cubes.
But see, I like the addition of those three characters, because while they carry a little bit of dramatic weight, they're mostly there for color, no pun intended. They're mostly there to A, throw in some interesting visual distinctiveness, which I think is significant for the piece and helps emphasize visually the alternate dimension story that we have going in a way that just, hey, I'm Peter Parker from another dimension, doesn't quite do in the same way. But I also think that it just adds to the milieu of the film, that they don't have arcs in the way that Peter B. Parker or Gwen do, and they don't have arcs in the way that Miles's dad or Miles's uncle do. But they add to the texture of the world and the texture of the story. And I think that, I mean, they don't take up that much time in terms of the story either. They are there and are present for a lot of it and throw in, yes, that's right, Peter Parker, or yes, that's right, Gwen. But for the most part, they, you know, have some interesting stuff for the action scenes, but they're there for entertainment purposes, which is a worthwhile thing for a 2-hour movie to do.
Entertainment. You sure?
I just want a Wikipedia list of Spider-Man villains read for 90 minutes.
I mean, I would have liked any time with the villains that make them people or characters.
Kingpin's a character. Liv is, or Doc Ock's a character.
We get motivation for Kingpin, the broadest of motivation.
It's not broad motivation. He loses his family and wants to get them back.
And that is what we got. That is the motivation. There is no time. We don't see him spend any time with his family prior to that one scene where we get, and I don't know, it for a movie that is supposed to be, my question, do you think this is do they assume knowledge of some of these characters, like Kingpin and, you know, Spider-Man? I think most people know who Spider-Man is. But, like, you know, anyone that's not just Peter Parker, do they assume some people have knowledge of that already?
No, I think they assume familiarity with names and presences to some extent, but I don't think they assume familiarity with history. So when they throw Kingpin out there, I don't think they expect you to know that his wife is Vanessa or what his history with the character is. But what I like about the film is I think it works on multiple levels, that if you are somebody like you and I who are steeped in Spider-Man lore, you know kind of the baggage that comes with Kingpin. And even if you're somebody who's just seen the movies or is more generally aware of the character, you probably have some sense of who he is. But if you've never seen a Spider-Man thing before, or just sort of know him from pop culture osmosis, you see this hulking brute who is banging his fist on the table of scientists, and you get an immediate sense for who he is and what he's about, even if you don't know his extensive history. I think that was one of the things that the film does well, is putting out these characters that work at multiple levels, that if you love Spider-Man and know everything about Spider-Man, there's little Easter eggs and layers to appreciate. But if you're somebody who's fairly new or meeting many of these characters for the first time, they get introductions and fit into certain molds or familiar rhythms that make it easy to recognize where they fit into the story.
I so many people criticize the MCU movies for having no villains, you know, having bad villains. Or meaningless villains for the most part. You know, for the longest time, it was Loki and no one else. Everyone talks about the good villains. I mean, I disagreed mostly with that criticism, but I understood it. This movie doesn't do anything different, but no one complains about it. I like Kingpin. I think Kingpin is a great villain. I like the Lady Doc Ock. I like the weird, I don't know what scorpion they used, because he's doesn't have half of his limb. He's like a torso in a spider body. And I'm not familiar with that version of Scorpion. He's pretty cool. Looks cool, at least. There's nothing really else there to him. He's just a mercenary. That's how long. Okay, I'm asking you, Andrew, how long before you realize that the uncle was the Prowler?
Well, so let me ask you, I guess, are we full spoilers?
Yeah,
here,
we're full spoilers. Yeah, the movie's been out for like 3 months. So, yeah, there's very little doubt that, yes, full spoilers, obviously. Yes, 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 yes.
So I did not realize, I guess this was the weird thing. I assumed that Miles's uncle was the Prowler because I knew that from prior adaptations.
Right.
But I didn't realize that the purple zooming guy was the Prowler until later in the movie. So I'm probably a bad test case for this.
I don't know. I don't think it was trying to be like, I don't know if it was supposed to be a twist or not, like a big, "Ooh, we gotcha."
I think it was.
I mean, it's, he goes, well, how do you know about this place? I did some engineering work down here in the sewer when they're doing the graffiti. In the sewers that lead to the MacGuffin, the space-time MacGuffin.
I mean, I think they make it pretty clear that he's into some shady stuff that's probably affiliated with bad guys, but I didn't necessarily think they made it super obvious if you didn't know going in that he was the Prowler. There's a lot of ways he could be involved with the Kingpin that wouldn't end up being a cape mercenary. Now, granted, the law of preservation of characters suggests that if you have the character in a comic book, they have to become a superhero or a supervillain at some point. But that fact notwithstanding,
Where's that law written?
It was, I assume it is written in the annals where Jimmy Olsen has to like get and lose superpowers every week or so.
Do you know? I don't know if you know the fun fact about Jimmy Olsen.
What is the fun fact about Jimmy Olsen?
The fun fact about Jimmy Olsen, him and Harley Quinn, they share a similarity in that.
Did they originate on the TV show?
They both originated in other places and then came to the comics later. Jimmy Olsen was originally on the radio show for Superman.
Yeah.
And then he was brought into the comic books, much like Harley Quinn was in the animated series and brought into the comic books, which not many people
think. I believe about. There's a TV Tropes term for that called canon immigrant. It's interesting to me how people true to the Spider-Verse story start in sort of one pocket of the universe and move to another.
Yeah. I mean, like, that it is what the Spider-Verse, like, there are multiple Spider-Verse comics at this point. I don't know if they've wrapped up their most recent one or not. It has been running for a while. I mostly ignore them because I have no connection to 2019's Peter Parker in Marvel Comics, which is fine. That's nothing to do with me. I mean, with them, it's really me. It's a me thing. I think I've outgrown him, maybe, or the fact that I'm going to bring up him selling his soul to Mephisto like 1,000 times before my life ends. but I don't know. It's when I say it's hip, I mean, like, it has hip hop and pop music in it, and it's very colorful and bright in the ways that even the MCU, which is generally much brighter than, let's say, most, until, like, I hear Aquaman, it's very colorful, but I haven't seen it. Also, here it's bad. But have you seen Aquaman?
I have not. I'm a little DC extended universe scarred at this point, so yeah, I will see it. But I wasn't exactly racing to the theater to see what we've been referring to as Aquaman's undersea bro-down.
I've heard that it's not good, but I don't know. I haven't seen it myself. But MCU movies are generally brighter, but they're not like this colorful. They're certainly not as colorful as this movie, and I think that's the other, and obviously there are people of color in the movie, which I think is another thing that is attractive to, the type of people I follow on Twitter. They could give a single crap about Tom Holland Peter Parker, but they watch this and they go, oh, this is new and interesting because it's Miles Morales has a Afro-Latino person of color as Spider-Man, which is, I think, I don't know, it feels like anyone could be behind the mask, it seems like, is one of the tenets of the film, is that you don't have to look like Peter Parker, and you can still be Spider-Man.
I agree with that. I think that one of the points of the film is to emphasize that it's more the character of the person who's donning the mask than what they look like or where they come from. But at the same time, I mean, I think that is a distinguishing feature of the film. Like, I'm somebody who loved Spider-Man Homecoming and thinks, you know, despite having grown up with different actors playing the role, Tom Holland feels the most like Spider-Man to me of any of the live action actors. But at the same time, it's very interesting getting to see a story from a different perspective. And I don't mean that just in terms of Miles, in terms of the perspective that somebody who grows up where Miles grows up, what he brings to the role of Spider-Man, or the mantle of Spider-Man through that, the different challenges that he faces than what Peter Parker would face. It's not just, okay, hey, we've changed the name and changed the heritage of this character. Like, where Miles comes from is an integral part of this movie. And that changes the point of view in a way that distinguishes it from, as the movie itself jokes about, the scads and scads of other Spider-Man stories we've gotten over the years. Now, obviously, I'm sure it overlaps with the comic book Miles to some extent, but at least on the big screen and to a certain extent the small screen, this is a different take on Spider-Man, not just because of who's behind it, but because of that perspective that is suffused through the film from beginning to end.
Yeah, I support that, like, I support that idea being in a movie that's accessible to a lot of people. I'm an edge case. I am a person who's read lots of Spider-Man comics, and that message doesn't mean I agree. It can be anyone behind the mask, and it has been many times in comic books. And Miles Morales as a character has existed for a long time now in the comics. Certainly not as long as Peter Parker has, but I've read a lot of Spider-Gwen. I've read a lot of these books, and it's not a big deal to me. You think it is a big deal to a lot of people? You think this is like, wow, it's Spider-Man and it's not Peter, it's a black kid?
I read the message of the film in many ways to be a preemptive strike against the people who would say, and I think there's a lot of them out there, unfortunately, that this is not Peter Parker, and so this isn't a real Spider-Man movie. I think all you have to do is look at the backlash from when they were doing casting notices for The Amazing Spider-Man, and there was a lot of talk about, hey, Donald Glover should play, should be Spider-Man in this film. And there was a pretty massive pushback to it. Now, granted, that was, you know, some time ago. It wasn't a long, long time ago, and maybe things have progressed since then, and Miles has been in the general ether of comic book fandom since that point, but... I mean, and there were, you'll know more about this than I do, Robbie, but my understanding is at least that there was a lot of pushback to Miles taking over for Peter Parker in the Ultimate Universe as well, that there was some disdain of him as a pretender to the throne. So, I mean, I think it is a big deal to people. I think it's a big deal to have Spider-Man represented in this way for the first time in a major motion picture. I think it's a big deal to have this perspective put into a Spider-Man story in a broader popular audience for it. And I think all you have to do is look at responses to things like to comic book movies like Black Panther and Wonder Woman to say there's been an unmet need in the film community and in for at least comic book stories to where there's a lot of people who this is meaningful to them, that their Spider-Man, a Spider-Man who looks like them, who comes from places that they come from, who's experienced things that they have experienced, is valid and vibrant and true a Spider-Man as any other. I, at the end of the day, I do think that's a big deal. And I can understand how it may not be a big deal when, you know, you comic books, to your point, by their very nature, have had alternate universe stories for a long time. And you can get pretty used to the idea that, yeah, there's a million different versions of these characters. And it's not the first time that the Spider-Man franchise has done this sort of thing, and it's definitely not the first time the comic books have done it. But I think beyond folks like you and I, who are perhaps a little jaded at how much we've seen alternate takes on these characters, there is something meaningful by having an Afro-Latino Spider-Man, and beyond that, making it specific to that community and to his specific challenges, taking on that mantle.
And I think that's ultimately my problem. It's not really a problem. My complaint is I want more Miles. I don't care about, like, the current Miles comic, just Spider-Man, adjectiveless Spider-Man is the current Miles Morales comic book.
That's an odd title.
You're very funny, Andrew.
I get by.
It's great. I enjoy it. I recommend the last one as well. Because now he is in the current comic books. He is just in the normal 616 universe. The Ultimate Universe exploded, or whatever you wanted. And they poured it over like the four Ultimate characters that they thought were worthwhile. They came over, and then everyone else is gone forever until they need them.
Poor other characters.
Until they need them, they'll come. At any point, they go, oh, we want the Ultimate Jean Grey. They'll bring her over. It doesn't matter. But there's enough Marvel characters in the general 616. I think the ones off the top of my head are Miles and the evil Reed Richards, I think, are the two that off the top of my head are currently being used a lot in the normal 616 versus any other characters from the Ultimate Universe. But I don't, like, I'd rather there just be a Miles movie where he doesn't, I don't know why, like, where they just don't have the dimension hopping and don't have the, hey, look at, isn't this strange Spider-Man? I don't know. It's all nitpicky, nerdy stuff. And I understand that, but it doesn't change the fact that, like, I could just have a Miles movie. I just want Miles to not have to, I don't need Miles to, like, have to become Spider-Man, have to see, like, the manga Spider-Girl with the mech. I don't, like, it's cute, even though my wife hated the little spider, because she hates spiders.
Why did she hate the spider?
She hates spiders, in general.
The spider bot, or the, like,
no, the little actual spider.
Oh, okay. She's okay with spider mechas. Spider,
yeah, the mech's fine. She's, like, funnily then, but the moment that the spider came out, the first time we saw the little tiny actual spider, she was like, ew, no. She didn't like that, which I understand. I'm not a fan of actual spiders in general either.
I mean, I'm sympathetic. I'm not necessarily the biggest fan in the world, but When you go see a movie called Spider-Man, I feel like there's a certain level of assumption of the risk of seeing spiders.
I know. It's not, she understood. It's not a big deal, but it is, I don't know. I feel like it is half measures. I guess that's what they wanted, though. They wanted a way to transition people into, look, there's all these different Spider-Men. There's so many. They're spider women and spider whatever. There's Gwen Stacy, although I think there's a little bit something is lost there as well from Gwen, because there's no mention of Gwen Stacy, the normal.
But she is Gwen, right?
That is Gwen Stacy. That is
okay. Yeah.
That is absolutely a different Gwen Stacy that becomes Spider Woman, like they say in the movie. I feel like by not including. Like, that's why I feel like Spider-Gwen is such a cool character in the comic books, is because we have that knowledge of, like, Spider-Gwen was just a girlfriend that got killed, you know, by the Green Goblin. And, like, and she was there to give Spider-Man something to care about. And she's not an exception. There's a lot of characters like that, and especially 70s comic books. But the fact that she is now the main character of a comic book and she carries it and she's awesome, I feel like having that knowledge makes it a little bit more impactful and makes it, I don't know, maybe that's just implicit in the fact, yeah, I am Spider-Woman in my universe and I can be, you know?
I guess I'd say two things to that. I'd say one, I feel like they define Gwen Stacy for the purposes of the film in the film. Like once again, people like us who have the background, there is some impact there knowing that there is a subversion or a correction from how Gwen was treated in the previous comic books. But I don't think that knowledge is essential to appreciate Gwen in this movie, that she is her own character. And I think what I kind of like about it is you could change her name. You could make her, you know, I don't know. I'm bad at coming up with names, but she could be Regina Fillmore at Spider-Woman. And it wouldn't make a difference because it's about her character in the film, independent of Gwen Stacy's broader history in the spider community. Again, that's a bonus for people like us. And at the same time, like it's not her movie. There will be her movie, but she has a fully fledged arc here.
You think there's any more?
I believe there's been explicit talk that there's going to be a Gwen Stacy, a Spider-Gwen spinoff movie. I may be pulling that out of my behind, but I think that's been discussed or disseminated in the public.
I have not heard any of it, so I don't know. I'd go see it.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is I feel like this movie is such a great introduction to all of these characters. And I know that there are a lot of Spider-Men and Spider-Women and Spider-Animals in this movie, but it's very much Miles' story. He interacts with these people, but everyone from Peter B. Parker to Gwen to Dad to the Prowler are in service of the story of Miles figuring out who he is and figuring what it means to be Spider-Man. I like it as a Miles story. I, as somebody who has seen at least two other renditions of Peter Parker going into the Spider-Verse, I feel like it is more focused on him and less on the, like, hey, look at the other wacky, crazy spider people that you're going to run into than a lot of the other attempts at this kind of story have been.
I want to talk about how this movie looks, Andrew.
Let's do it. I assume nothing but good things. Double thumbs up love from Robbie.
I mean, I think it's undeniably a beautiful film. I've yet to see someone who say, oh, it doesn't look good. Because if anything, it looks great. It's colorful and dynamic and manages to frame, you know, the action and emotional scenes equally well. I think and this is another thing that I thought of at the time when I was watching it or even right after. I thought, wow, man, that thing is stunning. It's so beautiful, so rich in color. Which is a thing that I'm glad it does, because, God forbid, we have comic book movies that have color in them. Like, colors other than, like, muted greens and blues and orange.
Gunmetal or go home.
You know, just it's the color of Superman's suit. That's all the color we get. We get that color and gray. Those are your choices. So if you know, when I was watching it, I would all, you know, you just kind of, it just washes over you, and it's just, it's hard to even like, I don't think I saw, I've only seen the movie once, and I'll watch it again when it comes out on video or digital download or whatever format.
When it comes out for the Victrola.
Yeah, exactly. When I rent it through iTunes or YouTube or whatever. But I don't think I absorbed every detail. I don't think anyone could. It's just, it's kind of overwhelming because it's just awash in this spectrum. And it's kind of a thing that sprung on me over time as I've thought more about the movie. And as we've been, if you told me you want to do a podcast about this, and I was like, okay. And I thought about the visuals, and I'm, you know, you read reviews, everyone is glowing about the visuals, and and they talk about how it's captured comic books in a way that nothing else ever has on the big screen, captured the visuals style of comic books. And, you know, they do not shy away from that, you know, using panel transitions and palettes and, you know, various comic book effects that have been utilized over the years throughout the whole film for in all kinds of situations, during action scenes, during transitions, during like even just kind of as background flavor, not necessarily even at like meaningful use. It still is just there to kind of present this comic book world that we're entering. And the more I thought of it, I don't know. Have you ever watched a motion comic, Andrew?
I watched the motion comic for, I think, the first installment of Watchmen.
That's the most, by far the most popular one. And I kept coming back to that thought. And like, obviously, motion comics are awful. They're terrible. No one should watch them. They should not exist. I don't know why people make them. And I think they're, I mean, you still see them from time to time. And you still see people like do it on their own time. Like, they just go, I like this comic, so I'm gonna make a motion comic out of it. And like, I despise motion comics because they're not, the whole point of comic books is you're communicating motion without the motion. Like, the art itself is communicating what you, if the art itself is not doing a good enough job, then that's not, I don't, motion, a motion comic is not gonna fix that problem. And a motion comic, all it turns into is bad animation, which is a lot of people, that's, I quote from someone, I don't remember who. And I don't think it's necessarily bad that the movie used all these motifs from comic books to help the animation. But at the end of the day, the comic book purist inside of me goes, why can't we just let comic books be comic books and animation be animation? Why do we have to make them we have to mix them together and try and use that storytelling? I don't know. And that is a minute, nerdy, nitpicky thing. But it is, well, I've seen so many times people go like, oh yeah, it looks like a comic book. I'm like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't look like a comic book. A comic book is different.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what I think the defense of it is that it's not imitating a comic book. It's not doing the motion comic thing and just saying, hey, let's take this pre-existing idea and spackle some kind of gimmick onto it. It's using the tropes of comic book storytelling visually to A, inform the style of the film, which makes it distinctive from the scads of other Spider-Man stories that have existed in lots of different media. But it also integrates it into what the film is doing dramatically at times. Like, I think one of the best sequences in the film is when Miles, to be little more specific, in a movie with a lot of Spider-Men.
I mean, I knew what you're saying.
When Miles first gets his powers, like, is bitten by the spider and is realizing that, oh my God, these things are happening to me. The way they use the, I'm not sure what the thought bubble is the wrong term, but the little boxes to indicate his inner monologue, times when they use the onomatopoeia clouds when he's, you know, scaling buildings or things like that. It adds texture and distinctiveness to the transformation, that he has gone through something and is now changed by it. And what I liked about the visual style is, yes, it was a feast for the eyes at almost all times. And I felt like you did. There were definitely times when it was almost overwhelming, especially in that final fight where you've just got tons and tons of stuff swirling all around. There's a lot to take in there. But at the same time, the reason it's using a lot of these techniques is to, A, just give it that flavor, to make it distinctive, but to also use them to, in a three-dimensional kinetic medium, to help convey the story, which is what I appreciate about it. It's not just adopting comic books, it's integrating comic books and the visual style in a way that I don't think skimps on its abilities as animation, and I don't think is a disservice to any of the visual techniques that they're borrowing from and translating into a different medium.
Do you think it's repeatable?
I think it's repeatable for this franchise. I think that if other people start doing it, it will seem like a pale imitation. But I think this is just how Miles Morales' universe works. I think there's no reason you can't use these same kinds of tropes, visual tropes, for different stories in the same way that you can use them for different stories in print comic books.
See, that, and that's
it won't have the novelty, obviously. But you don't need the novelty. That's what I'm saying. Is it's not just a novelty. It's not just a gimmick. It's functional both to the visual style and to the storytelling.
I feel like if I went to see, let's say there is a sequel to this, and I don't know if it's going to be, or if they make two, they do another Miles movie and then a Spider-Gwen movie. Regardless, if I saw them using those same visual tricks again, I don't know if they would mean the same. I went, oh, that's interesting. They used narration boxes. If you want to, that's there. It's very, you know, there's not a fancy name for the little square or rectangles of thought. It's just narration boxes generally.
Makes sense. Yeah. Keep it simple.
Very simple. The one time I've seen, yeah, it's great. If I start seeing a second or a third or a fourth movie, the languages of film animation and languages of comic books are different, and they are built for those mediums. And I think it's neat to see that stuff, but I don't think it added any depth to the movie. I think it's just a gimmick of visual tricks that are nice for this one movie. I don't know if I see them again and again and again, which is what's going to happen, I assume, because if something works, something gets attention and gets lots of, I assume they will do it again and again and again. I don't know if I'm certainly don't think I'm going to go, great. Another short thought explosion of, oh no, or something, whatever, you know, that they use for comic effect multiple times in the film and sometimes dramatic effect even. What does that communicate that a well animated facial expression doesn't? And if I,
what?
What does it add? Does it, if I've seen it for the fourth or fifth or sixth time, why is it there? If it's not novel anymore, I don't need to know that he's alarmed. I can look at his face and see he's alarmed. It's a problem with comic books sometimes too, but it, and that's the thing. Like, it's the strangest thing to me also is that, and I think honestly it adds to the appeal of this film, is that it's stealing a lot of these things from old comic books. Like a lot of the visual motifs they take from comics are from Silver Age comic books. People won't use, like, there's not any, like, if people use effects, which they certainly still do, it's generally much more nuanced now, usually intricately crafted. They don't use just kind of cookie cutter bam pals. And I think that probably adds a visual flavor of the film because the rest of it feels so new and colorful and hip. And then you have this kind of old Silver Age aesthetic from comic books laid over top of it. I don't know if you think it's still going to have that same effect the fifth time in?
If nothing else, it just gives the film and the look of the film, the aesthetic, a distinctive particular flavor. I mean, there's scads and scads of animated films that come out, and you know, there's some similarities and differences between them. But in the same way that, you know, when Matt Groening draws a human figure, it's got a distinctive style relative to, you know, Seth MacFarlane or anybody else drawing a human figure. There's a distinctive look to it. I appreciate the fact that the film has a distinctive aesthetic, and I'm not just watching a Pixar film that's happens to be about Spider-Man, or I'm not just watching a DreamWorks film that happens to be about Spider-Man. There's a unique style that applies when you're playing in this sandbox. And I trust, given how creative the use of some of the storytelling tropes was in this particular outing, that they can do it again, that they can find new places to take it and new ways to use those things. But even if they don't, even if it never evolves from here, it may not be novel to me, but I appreciate that this corner of the Marvel Universe has its own distinct look, and that's just how characters look when they're there.
I'm going to nitpick some things about powers, Andrew.
Let's hear it.
The Kingpin is just a man. He would lose.
Maybe in your universe.
No, it doesn't. No, do not. I don't want to hear it. He's a very big, strong man. He is Miles Morales. Is like Superman compared to the Kingpin. I don't like it. I know it is a very powerful dynamic between the two, because Miles is a small figure compared to this massive hulking Kingpin guy. But Miles, my strongest criticism, honestly, is that final action sequence is incoherent. I don't know what's happening anytime. I mean, I think some of that's intentional because all the MacGuffin went off and everything's getting sucked into a black hole or something. I don't know.
I'll say at parts, I think it's intentionally disorienting because Miles is disoriented and the characters are disoriented.
But again, any fight between Miles and the Kingpin would be over in like, this is me putting in my comic book guy voice that actually. Miles would not have any problem fighting the Kingpin. The only reason he was able to kill Peter in the beginning is because Peter was awfully, terribly wounded. But he's just a dude, and Miles is, like, can pick up cars without effort. Like, I know that it's just them trying to communicate his struggle and make it dramatic. But I just was kind of like, okay, I know he's gonna win. Let's just get this.
I mean, maybe in this universe, Kingpin took some abortive super soldier serum and it made him super strong. Like, it's comics. There's a million ways that he could have gotten strong for these, you know, day and a half or whatever it is. This Kingpin doesn't have to be other Kingpins in the same way that this Spider-Man doesn't have to be other Spider-Man. Adaptations are allowed to set their own rules and craft characters and distill them to what's needed for the particular stories that they are telling. If anything, I think that's a laudable impulse in any filmmaker, any storyteller, and a good adaptation does that. And that's, I don't know. I totally understand walking into a film and saying, hey, that's not my Spock. And that's not my... You know, so forth and so on. Like, I get it. I have 100% had that feeling. And I don't want to diminish anybody who has connections to particular characters and you see a funhouse mirror version of them and they're not recognizable to you. And it can dampen your enjoyment of a film or a television show or anything. But at the same time, I try to let go of that. I try to let an individual story or movie that I'm watching be its own thing and craft recognizable characters, adapt them into what it needs them to do, adapt them in what it needs them to be to tell the story it wants to tell. And I when I feel that way, I feel like the fault is in me and not in the show, if that makes sense.
Again, I don't necessarily, I think this movie is very good. And I think ultimately it does tell the story of Miles. Like, it connect, I think, the thematically and tonally, it does everything well and good. It's just, when I connect to, when I watch superhero movies, and even when I read superhero comics, even, the appeal to me a lot of the time, when I'm seeing, especially when you are, when the title of the movie is Into the Spider-Verse, and look at all these different versions of Spider-Man. Look at them. They're all weird and strange and different, and not the one we expect. The one we know dies 5 minutes into the movie. And the movie is giving us all these different versions of Spider-Man and is pulling from all these different universes from the multiverse. And it is a thing that I used to love about comic books, about the fact that there were so many permutations of these characters. And now I'm getting weary of it. I'm weary of crossovers. I'm weary of, like, literally, they just use them as memes now. Like, literally, the current Spider-Verse comic book is just full of memes about, like, someone made a joke on the internet about a Spider-Man that's just made out of spiders, and he throws spiders at people. That's his power. And so that's now a real Spider-Man in the comics. Like, they just went, oh, that's funny, let's make that a comic book character.
So is what you're telling me, Robbie, that you've just had too much of this sort of thing? That there's, there's no novelty to it, but even beyond that, it is actively exhausting for you to see this kind of story being told?
I don't know about exhausting, because I don't want to say that I came out of this movie and felt exhausted, although it is a lot. It is a lot of stimulation. I definitely did want to kind of afterwards just kind of chill for a bit. And maybe that's just because I'm old, not because of this particular movie. Because anytime I go to the movies nowadays, it's just like, man, it's loud. Man, there's people. Man, blah, blah, blah. Which is just, I'm an old man talking.
Damn kids won't get off their phones.
I Alamo Drafthouse, I saw this. My first movie I saw in Austin at the Alamo Drafthouse, where they kick people out of the theater for being on your phone. So that was
exactly. You've got the phone Gestapo in your service.
They do have the phone Gestapo, even though throughout the movie they have wait staff walking directly in front of you. So I don't know why that's. They're like, no, you can't be on your phone. But our waiter will literally put their head right in front of you during the climax of the film.
Yeah, I will say I found that to be ironic too. That the franchise for movies that is most virulent and most devoted to, like, this pure experience and undisturbed experience is also the one that has waitstaff constantly running around and having a visual distraction at the edge of your viewing space. So,
but
it's, demands of the market, I assume.
It is the movie is very full of movement and action, and it is a lot to absorb all at once, but. And then I think that is driven back to my complaints about everyone that isn't Miles or Gwen or Peter, is when you start adding in these little things. Yeah, you're right. They add in. They're not important. They're comic relief a lot of the time, or they're just a chorus or background flavor to remind us. There's so many of these. There's past Spider-Man and Spider-Man Noir and Penny Parker. There's going to be dozens of other Spider-Men out there. It is subtle kind of world building, implying this greater, grander world of Spider-Man. I just want.
And they're fun.
Andrew, I don't find Spider-Man Noir fun. I don't find Spider-Ham fun. Penny Parker is at least interesting because of her, like, kind of Eastern comics manga influence in her. I think that's interesting, and I think it does add a lot of distinct flavor. I don't need any Looney Tunes characters in my Spider-Man movie.
I don't need a lot, but I'll take, 5 minutes over the course of a 2-hour film.
And I would say that all the voice actors do an amazing job. We haven't mentioned the voice acting at all, but it's all almost universally great. But literally every time Spider-Man Noir talks, I go, oh, that's Nicolas Cage. And every time Spider-Ham talks, I'm like, oh, that's John Mulaney. Like, I just, all I do is hear their voice. I don't see them as, I don't, you know, I don't, there's kind of a suspension of disbelief breaking at that point when I hear their voices, because they are, Nicolas Cage certainly very well known, but John Mulaney just has a very distinct voice, and I understand why they cast him as Spider-Ham. I don't like Spider-Ham. I don't care if people hate me for it. Come at me. I don't care. I don't like Spider-Ham at all. No interest. And that is the thing. It's just, he's a meme. It's just it feels like I'm just getting distracted. I'm pulling away. You're pulling me away from Miles, who I care about Miles, and I want to see him fight Kingpin. And then I have to see, oh, look, isn't it fun that Spider-Ham has a cartoon hammer? Isn't that funny?
Yes. The answer is yes. I mean, again, different strokes for different folks. I don't want to cast aspersions. If Spider-Ham isn't your thing,
I can't. If
Spider-Man Noir is not your thing.
Spider-Man Noir is it's a very, like, I understand why they picked him, I guess, because of the fact that every time you cut away, you have very, like, you can have those noir, like, shadows, and you know, they make the joke about the wind and stuff. Like, there's no wind in here.
And again, it allows you to do different things visually to signify that these are characters from a different universe.
Yeah, I assume that's why they picked the ancillary spider people, is because of the fact that you can add different visual flair. I don't like when I'm reading the spider, if I'm reading a comic book, let's say, and it's a Spider-Man story, but then five different other Spider-Men show up, I'm just like, maybe it makes me an old disillusioned old comic book fan, which I generally don't want to be connected to that type of stereotype, but just give me the core guys and let them have more story and let them say funny lines. Why can't Miles be funnier? Why can't Spider-Gwen have a laugh
Miles
line?
Miles does get good lines. I mean, I don't... So again, I think regardless of what you did with Miles and Peter and Gwen, these characters serve that purpose of A, world building, showing you that there's other Spider-Men out there, but B, letting the animators show off to some degree and emphasizing in an instantly recognizable, grokkable way, for lack of a better term, that these are people from different places. I don't think that's insignificant in this film. And I also think there's nothing wrong with a little comic relief and a little bit of fun in that way. That seeing some Looney Tunes antics is enjoyable for me as somebody who likes Looney Tunes. And it's not like they overdid it. It's not like it was constant. They just had a few bits here and there, which is plenty. And, you know, for Spider-Man Noir, I'll admit, I like Nicolas Cage. I've seen Nicolas Cage in a decent number of films and other projects. I did not recognize his voice. Maybe I just wasn't primed for it. The second time that I watched the movie, I 100% recognized it. But at the same time, you know, in that first run through, I just saw the grizzled, like, you know, nothing's right in this world, not unless you make it right. Like, I got the grizzled archetype character, and then the movie had fun with it. So, I mean, if they had tried to give those characters arcs in the same way that they do for Miles and Peter and Gwen, if they had tried to make them more than background characters who have the occasional entertaining bit, I might feel the same way. But I think there was a lot of moderation to this film and how those kinds of characters were used and what they were used for that made it work for me.
Do you have any criticisms at all, Andrew?
I would say my criticism of the film is that they signpost Miles's self-actualization moment a little bit for my taste. I didn't necessarily need that scene where he's, you know, prior to the famous, now famous, soon to be famous, what's up danger sequence. I didn't need to have the voiceover quotes from important people in his life. And there were a few lines of dialogue here and there where they were a little too cute with the repetition or a little too heavy-handed about what the transformation has now happened, and we want to let you know that directly rather than letting you just see it through Miles's actions. That I think was probably my biggest criticism of the film. I liked the story they told. I liked Miles's trajectory. You know, there was a little bit of rushing there, but I think they do a good job of explaining how his, or at least, you know, signifying how his dad's faith in him and his dad's trust in him is something that allows him to self-actualize and become a better, more confident person and do what he needs to do and, you know, take a leap and not give up and live up to his expectations and so forth and so on. But there were times when they really tried to hammer that point home in terms of what the characters were saying to each other that felt like a little much to me, that I could have done them dialing it back and making it a little bit more subtle in places.
I mean, I would argue the entire movie is like that, in that it is not trying to be subtle. I don't think subtlety is what it's aiming for. I mean, the visuals certainly aren't subtle. They certainly do signpost all that stuff. I think they are trying to make all this stuff incredibly clear for the audience. And plus, I think they have an eye in this towards children. I think this film is, I'm not sure. It feels at times it's very like they want kids to get it, you know, in a way that the MCU is not necessarily concerned with. You know, I think, you know, you watch Winter Soldier, it's certainly not aimed at kids. This film, it feels like part of it is. It feels like it has an eye towards a younger audience.
I think that's right. And honestly, oddly enough, just the other day, I got a similar, I guess, critique of my critique about The Legend of Korra for that reason, where I was making similar complaints about signposting the main character's changes over the course of the show in terms of dialogue. And somebody raised the valid point that there are a number of members of the audience who are likely to be younger kids and maybe need a little bit of hand-holding to understand what's happening. In the same way that you can't necessarily unpack that part of your brain that knows who these characters were in prior adaptations and have them feel wrong, I can't unpack the part of my brain that says, like, no, I can rationally accept that it's perfectly valid to simplify certain things or signpost certain things so that younger kids get it. I can't help but, like, see those things and roll my eyes a little bit and not go like, yes, I already understood this movie. You don't need to, you know, elbow me in the ribs and say, do you get it? But again, that's a fault with me, not a fault with the movie to some extent.
What are you talking about, Andrew? All of us are completely blameless humans. And if we don't like art, it's something wrong with the art. Don't you know?
Art is a buffet. You should be able to pick and choose exactly what you want and have it made to your specifications.
I mean, that's a... What kind of buffets are you going to?
I guess ones with omelet bars.
That's one of the fancy buffets. They cost $25 at Vegas. You get your crab legs. I mean, if you're going to go to a buffet, those are the ones to go to. No, I'm not. That's the buffet I want. I want the buffet with the prime rib.
When I was a kid, and I got to pick where we went out, which restaurant we went out to on my birthday, there were more than one occasion where I picked Golden Corral, so I'm perhaps not the best tastemaker when it comes to buffets.
I mean,
so take my metaphor with a grain of salt.
I'm not picky. I will go from the lowest, most garbage buffet to the fanciest $50 a head buffet. I'm just married to someone who will not go to the Golden Corral and lower ilk of the buffet universe. We only go to the very nice buffets, so I will take them when I get them.
You can take her to another universe where Golden Corral is like the apotheosis of all buffets in any dimension.
Yeah, and I think that's it's another thing I think is specifically because I read a lot of comic books where I'm not impressed by. I've seen lots of posts on the internet about the, you know, the alternate versions of movies and TV shows and stores that you see in the background shots over and over and over again in the movie. And they're like, isn't that funny? Isn't that like, that's referencing this and this is referencing that and this blah, blah, blah. Every comic book on Earth, it seems, has their version of a, like, what do they call that? Greeking? Isn't that what they, when you cover up a brand name with something else?
I'm not familiar with that term, but
I saw it in Mythbusters, I think, because they have, whenever they use a brand name item, they have to relabel it with like a generic thing. And I think
beer.
Yeah, I think Adam Savage called it greeking. I'm not sure if that's right though. That's what I want to say, but regardless, every comic book has that going on Like, there's always, like, it's not Starbucks, it's Starducks, or what, you know, whatever. That's not a good one, but you understand. A lot of analogs over and over and over and over and over and over again. And
I'm going to ask you a very important question, Robbie.
Okay.
Have you been scarred by Mapple and MyPause and that sort of thing?
Also true. You yes.
Can't handle this anymore?
100%. I will 100%. Yes. The Simpsons are guilty as anyone.
Well, I guess I'll say those things didn't blow me away. I did enjoy getting to see a tribute to Clone High in the background as a sort of in-joke to Lord and Miller's history and a show that I wish was still we'd gotten enough to get a movie someday. But, I mean, they're Easter eggs at the end of the day. They're fun, and you see them for 2 seconds. They didn't blow me away, but they served the purpose in an entertaining way for me.
I know. It's, again, a minor point. It's just I am just disenfranchised with all this. Hey, soundtrack's great. I'll say that. Soundtrack's amazing. I've listened to it multiple times after the movie. Start a riot. If I want to get energetic and do the dishes, put that on. Start yelling at my dishwasher along with the song.
As we all do from time to time.
Yeah, just, you know, scaring my cats. Which I think that's, again, I think that is why it's so appealing to I think, an audience that is not generally care about superhero movies at all, is because it is hip. It has an awesome soundtrack. It's like Black Panther. I feel like Black Panther shares that same area. And I something's wrong with me. I'm not as impressed as everyone else.
I mean, it's not the first movie to use popular music in its soundtrack, but I think it uses it very well, and it uses it for a purpose. I mean, right down to Miles singing his song to help de-stress him when he's in a panic moment. And I guess it sort of ties back to the use of comic book aesthetic to me. I feel like when the film borrows from other places, it doesn't just lick the back of them and slap them on the movie. It integrates it into what the movie's doing. So
there's nice scenes.
Why do you hate fun, Robbie? I'm just
teasing. It's a problem. I understand. It was nice seeing Stan Lee. And I feel like this is the best Stan Lee cameo ever. And not just because
that's a tough call.
No, this is the best. There's not even one this is the best one ever, because it best represents who Stan Lee actually was in real life. Because
he sold crappy knockoffs of Spider-Man said people, you can't return them.
A preeminent salesman who's smiling and kind with a big sign right next to him, no returns. I think it's very accurate of what Stan Lee as a salesman, as the pitch man for Marvel Comics in the 60s and 70s was. And I think that is an in-joke that I did enjoy quite a bit. And all the other times he's a bus driver, he's a, you know, whatever, all the other roles he's been in different Marvel movies in the background. The Hugh Hefner one was pretty good in Iron Man, but I still think this is the one, the only one that, because every time, I don't know if you've had this experience, every time I've seen a Marvel movie and Stanley shows up, everyone goes they chuckle, everyone chuckles. I don't chuckle. Because I hate fun, as established. This time I did chuckle. I laughed, and I laughed harder than I think most people. I didn't just chuckle. I laughed. I thought it was actually clever. It wasn't just shoehorning a comic book creator into a movie. It was like, hey, that's actually funny. That's about that. I think that speaks to Stan Lee, the salesman. That's what he was.
Well, I do chuckle at the Stan Lee cameos, but I did definitely like this one here. And if nothing else, it seemed, particularly when timed with Stan's passing, that, you know, the I'm going to miss him line felt particularly resonant and particularly impactful given the events and his connection to that character. But I will say, if it changes your mind or if anything makes it seem worse, in the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon, Stan Lee plays the janitor at Peter Parker's high school and even gets an episode where he helps Peter fight the lizard. So he's a regular presence in that. And I'm not going to say it's defined Stan for me, but at least is one instance where he's gotten to do a little bit more than just have his 5 seconds of fame.
You should read Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, Andrew.
I will.
It's very good.
Add it to my list.
It's a very good history of both Marvel comics and broad comic books in more broader terms beyond just Marvel. But also, of course, obviously, a lot about Stan Lee and his role in comic books.
Well, this is probably fodder for another podcast, but I have mixed feelings about Stan Lee the person, but I kind of enjoy Stan Lee the Marvel mascot, and I'm able to sort of separate the two in my head to some extent, if that makes sense.
I don't understand. Stan Lee is not Marvel. Again, it is a different podcast, but there's anyone who holds the people who hold some kind of anger against Stan Lee because he didn't try and give Jack Kirby money or Steve Ditko the creative rights to things. Stan Lee is not Marvel Comics. He worked for Marvel Comics. He was doing a job. They got the same. It was a raw deal. I don't disagree. That's not Stan Lee's fault. All work was in comic books was done for hire, and they signed the contracts, and it was probably unjust. But it's not. I don't blame Stan Lee for that. It's not. When he was editing an entire line of comic books and then writing eight of them, he had artists go the Marvel method where they would draw stuff on a page and then he would fill in the dialogue bubbles. But I don't go, oh, Stan Lee. It's not like Stan Lee was like putting his feet up on a desk and smoking cigars all day. He was busy. He was doing a lot of work. It's not like he wasn't doing anything. And that's another reason I would say read the Untold Story, Marvel Comics Untold Story. I feel like it gives a just appearance of everyone involved. It doesn't have, like, there's not a villain, which is some people like to paint Stan Lee as. He's just a guy who liked, he liked attention. But that's what Marvel Comics needed in the early 60s when they became a company. DC had been a company for 30 years at the time. They were established. Marvel was nothing. They needed someone to draw that attention. They needed a figure to stand on Stan's soapbox and yell and say, here, we're the competition. Pay attention to us.
Well, to go back to the putting your feet on the desk and smoking the cigar, the one other cameo that Stan Lee has in Into the Spider-Verse is he gets to voice J. Jonah Jameson in the last post-credit scene where they go back to the 60s Spider-Man, which apparently he'd always wanted to do, which is a nice little, again, 5-second touch.
Yeah. You haven't played the new Spider-Man game on PS4. I assume you haven't, but J. Jonah Jameson now hosts a podcast about Spider-Man a lot of the time and about the city, and you listen to it as you are swinging around the city, and it's very good. It's very well written, and that's now I think of J. Jonah Jameson. That's one of the first things I think of. It's very good. I don't know. I still think Into the Spider-Verse is very good. I don't know. And I love Miles. Miles is great. And I love Spider-Gwen. I don't know if I... here, this is another little nitpicky thing. It's the same problem I have with Batman Beyond.
Don't go hating on Batman Beyond, Robbie. We may have to have words.
Batman Beyond is a good show. I don't disagree there. And it's like, Batman Beyond is basically Spider-Man.
Batman coaching up Spider-Man. It's the dream, right?
Exactly. It is just basically a Spider-Man show again in the future with, you know, their fake future music. I always enjoyed a lot. But it exists, like Batman Beyond exists because Batman fails. Bruce Wayne fails. He doesn't succeed. And he quits because he almost he picks up a gun and then quits, retires. And the idea of a 45-year-old overweight, single, depressed Spider-Man upsets me. I want Peter Parker to have a happy life. In the long run, I want him to eventually succeed as a hero, and then he gets to marry Mary Jane, and then they have kids, and then grandkids, and he doesn't have to be Spider-Man anymore. and other heroes pick up the reins. Even Miles.
I mean, you have to have places for characters to go, Robbie. And Peter B. Parker has a rough time of it, and you get that. But then through the course of the movie, he makes peace with the idea of having children and what needed to happen, you know, what his relationship with himself and Mary Jane could look like in another world, literally. And you get at least the gesture that things get better for it.
That's true. It does have a relatively happy ending. It is just, again, it is more about having to see so many. Have you ever read? No, you haven't read it. I know you haven't. There's a comic book called Spider-Man Reign.
I have not read it, but I am aware of it.
Yeah.
I guess I know the details of it.
It's just The Dark Knight Returns, but Spider-Man, basically.
Yes.
And it's just very...
Where he pulled what they only fake out in Watchmen, that he basically gave Mary Jane cancer
because
of the radiation.
Yep, they did that, and it was very bad, and I don't like it at all. The art is good. Cary Andrews is a very good artist. We're not talking about Into the Spider-Verse much. Into the Spider-Verse is very good. I am not going to say it's not. I don't even think it's my top five superhero movies. I think the MCU just that is what I want. I love the MCU, and I think it is exactly that's what I want. This is very good, and I hope for sequels. I hope they are different just as much as this was different from other movies. Like, I hope they pull new tricks out of the hat.
For my part, I love the MCU as well, and a lot of those are among my favorite superhero movies. But what I think the best MCU movies do and have done is take interesting characters who are introduced in some particular point in their lives and then reach some realization and then build on that, take it someplace out different. Put them in different situations, have them have to face different challenges. I really liked Into the Spider-Verse, and I love it as a story of Miles Morales figuring out who he is, both as a person and as a hero. The way that the film is able to take those two different stories and tell them at the same time is almost masterful. And I am excited to see where they take the character from here. I fully expect that we're going to get another Miles movie. I have reason to think that we're going to get a Gwen movie, and we may even get a Spider-Man 2099 movie out of this as well. But I think the folks who have put this together, if they're still involved, I think they've shown that they know how to tell stories in this universe, stories with these characters, and stories with different kinds of characters from we're used to seeing, and making it familiar to how comic book stories work, but also unique and distinctive and particular to different perspectives at the same time. So I'm not sure where this falls in my superhero movie pantheon, but I'll say that I enjoyed it from beginning to end, and I'm definitely hungry for more.
I don't want Spider-Man 2099. I don't understand the appeal to any of the 2099 characters.
People like Batman Beyond, so presumably they'll like Spider-Man Beyond.
Yeah.
It's a different fight for another day.
Yeah, you're right. Andrew, what's some stuff people can check out on the internet about from you that you've made, that you've helped make, or even?
People who want to hear more of my ramblings about Spider-Man and Batman and other superheroes can find all of my writing from everywhere across the web. Links to it on my website, which is theandrewblog.net. It's three words, theandrewblog.net. You can also find me as part of Consequence of Sounds, expanded film and TV coverage. And you can find me on Twitter at theandrewblog. So thank you, Robbie, for letting me, you know, be somebody from another dimension who comes in and crashes your podcast. I hope I leave it in as good a shape as I found it.
There are no interdimensional MacGuffins here. I am not.
We know of.
Andrew, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Norman, and the show's website is SeroFanaticist.com. You can follow the Facebook page at Facebook.com/SeroFanaticist. If you like the show, could you please give it a good review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to it? Subscribe, tell your friends. All those things help get the word out, help more people find the show. And I thank you for it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.